Welcome back to Durker and Hott on Baseball, where I'll talk old school baseball with former Astros pitcher, broadcaster, and manager Larry Durker. This time, Larry and I talk about command for a pitcher. So many pitchers these days have plenty of power but very little command. They can't put their pitches where they want to get them in order to get the hitters out, and eventually it hurts them. That brings up a point I wanted to ask you about that relates to both these things today anyway, and that's pitchers with command. Isn't it command that separates the guy who stays in the big leagues from the guy who bounces up and down?
Yes, and they're obviously the command is an elusive thing to analyze. You can certainly say that Greg Maddux had better control than almost every other pitcher you'd see in the major leagues, and then you'll see certain guys that don't have very good control, and they're usually not there very long. But command, does that mean that you don't walk anybody, or does that mean that you don't throw any balls down the middle? Because there's two ways to be wild. You can be wild in the strike zone where they're going to hurt you with a bat, or you can be wild out of the strike zone when you're going to hurt yourself with walks. So command is when you have both, that you throw quality pitches and you still don't walk anybody. And with Maddux and a lot of other pitchers, if you get to that point where you're 3-2 or something and you can't afford to walk a guy, you throw a pitch around the knees and don't worry about hitting the corner. So if he does hit it well, it's probably a ground ball. So, you know, it is elusive saying whether a guy has command or not, but you could and still can pitch with that. Zach Greinke does that for the Astros. He's had some great games. He just paints. You know, he's just all on the corners all the time, and all of his pitches have some movement. He mixes them up and moves them around, and he doesn't walk very many guys.
Right.
Which is why he's got 200 wins or so.
And we talked about Tom Seaver in the same vein last time, and I remember when he was with the White Sox near the very end, and he was warming up in the bullpen, and this is when Dave Duncan was still with the White Sox, and Duncan said, "Boy, you don't have anything today." And Seaver said,
"Well, that's a nice positive thing to send a guy out there with."
Yeah.
Of course, Seaver probably knew it.
Oh, well, he did. And he said to Duncan, "Well, what do you mean?" Duncan says, "Look, you got no velocity at all." He says, "Look, velocity is the least important thing to me." He said, "I'm still hitting my spots while I'm warming up here. If I've got location, then I can still figure out a way to get these guys out." And so you've got to think that that's how he was able to sustain himself when you could tell from even his last years in Cincinnati before he went back to the Mets, went to the White Sox and Red Sox, that he'd lost a lot. But he still figured out a way to compete.
Yeah, he was a really an amazing pitcher and ball player, you know, fielder, hitter, everything. He was, you know, I really hate that we lost him so young and in kind of a quirky way, I guess. But he could do that almost all the pitchers, as they get older, if they're great pitchers, learn to get guys out without the kind of fastball they had when they were younger. And I guess the only guy that I think is an exception to that is Nolan Ryan, because he was pretty much a power pitcher all the way to the last pitch he threw. And, well, Roger Clemens, too. Roger still could get up in the mid-90s when he was well over 40 years old.
Yeah.
Well, most guys are going to end up like Warren Spahn or Maddux or Don Sutton. Or, you know, they're going to win over 300 games, but they're not going to do it all with the stuff they had when they came up.
Right. Obviously, though, it seems like they either had great command to start with or they developed that over a period of time. Do you think, as a general rule, that command is something that can be learned if your mechanics are sound?
Yes. I think it almost has to be learned if you're going to have any kind of a career at all. What you may get away with in the minor leagues is liable to end up in the seats of the major leagues.
Sure.
So, you've got to be able to have some command to stay in the league. On the other hand, if you really can throw 100 miles an hour and you can throw strikes, you may not have to have command or have any finesse or have anything other than a fastball that's really fast and has some movement, and you can throw three strikes before you throw four balls. But even that's going to, you know, that's not going to last too long because you're going to lose some velocity. But when we had Billy Wagner as our closer, he was throwing 98, 99, 100 a few times early in his career. He had a little elbow issue, and after that, he was still getting into the mid-90s and sometimes faster. But all throughout his career, he got better and better and better control. In the beginning, he didn't have much command of the corners with his fastball, and he didn't know where the breaking ball was going or how much it was going to break. But over the years, he got to the point where he worked the corners with his fastball, and he could throw the breaking ball behind in the count. He got better and better and better from repetition.
Now, you were a guy who never really walked that many. Looking over your stats here, you threw hard and you had command. Was some of that natural, or was that as a kid thrown to your dad, or how much of that's learned and how much of that's hereditary or a gift or whatever else you want to call that?
It was the same kind of like with Billy. I had more pitches that I could throw for strikes when I first came up, but I couldn't really try to hit corners with my fastball from the first pitch to a guy until the next guy. So early in my career, I'd throw pitches that I thought I could get over, and I'd try to just throw strikes. If it was a sinker or a slider, I'd try to throw a low strike, but I wouldn't try to throw a low strike right on the corner. And then if I get ahead in the count, then maybe I could throw a breaking ball in the dirt and see if a guy would chase it, or I could try to nip a corner with a fastball. But the point was, I had good enough stuff to get by just pitching into the strike zone. But I didn't pitch well enough to be one of the top guys in the league until I started being able to throw that fastball for the corner, first pitch in the count, and throw my breaking ball or change up behind in the count. It just evolved.
Do you buy the theory that as a general rule, a pitcher needs, say, I've heard it said, 500 innings in the minors to develop all that stuff before he's really big league ready as a general rule? Or is that just an individual thing?
Mostly, but you know, with a guy like Billy Wagner, he was never going to get those 500 innings because the Astros started him in the minor leagues every fifth day so that he could build up innings and he could work on a breaking ball. The raw stuff was there, but they wanted him to have the command. And so if they had used him as a closer, which is where he ended up, and which is where his whole career was designed for him to be a closer. But they wanted him to get innings in the minor leagues, and so they started him. Then when he came up, I doubt if he had more than 150 or 200 innings when he came up to the major leagues, and we just started him out instead of using him in the pressure situation in the ninth. They'd pitch him in the seventh or eighth. And so he got better and grew into the closer's role. So that wasn't 500 innings or 1,000 bats. And there are a few guys that have come almost straight to the major leagues as hitters and never spent much time in the minor leagues at all. Not many.
Right.
But I would say, as a guess, that each baseball athlete needs some amount of training before he's ready to take on the major leagues. But for one guy, it might be 500 innings, and for another guy, it might be 100. For another guy, it might even not make it till he's 30 years old and he's pitched over 1,000 innings in the minor leagues. So I don't buy hard and fast rules, this many at-bats or this many innings. I prefer eyewitness accounts. You know, is a pitcher, is he getting him out? Or are they, he's getting him out because he didn't walk anybody, but they get good swings at him. Well, maybe he's not ready yet. And so I think, you know, that's, in generally speaking, one of the difficulties with trying to analyze players with a computer instead of by watching them play is that one size doesn't fit all.
Right.
You know, you have to try to understand how is this going to translate into the major leagues. And so how many at-bats, how many innings? I think those are good guidelines. What's his velocity? You know, the radar gun. I think the radar gun, it may be the worst thing that ever happened to pitching, because a lot of scouts don't even watch a guy pitch anymore. They just use the radar gun and write down all the readings. And then, of course, the theory is if you get the guy with a 95-mile arm, Right, he has a little trouble throwing strikes. Well, let's get him anyway if we can, because we can teach him to throw strikes.
Right.
But if the raw material's not there, they don't even keep watching. You know, a guy may be a magnificent pitcher. No, there was a couple of years where Bob Tewksbury pitched for the Cardinals and was a big-time winner.
Yep.
Right-handed pitcher, and I think he couldn't throw any harder than about 85 miles an hour.
Jamie Moyer kind of guy.
Yeah, the other side of right-handed Jamie Moyer type of approach. So many nuances. And I think the analytics guys would probably say, yeah, but, you know, if you just use analytics, a lot of this stuff is going to just even out over time statistically. But for me, if you're going to make it to postseason, then most times three or four games that you win instead of lose is going to get you in, or three or four games that you lost that you could have won is going to eliminate you. So those little nuances can become important when every single game counts a lot, even though you play so many games. Down at the end, it's always, not always, but almost always a close race.
Yeah. Now, if you flashed back to, 1964, and if there were analytics guys then, there's probably no way you'd have been pitching in the big leagues at 18 or 19. Instead,
I wouldn't have been.
You know, it turned out a little differently because somebody had the vision and saw you pitch in person, and you passed their eye test that said, I think he can get big league hitters out. And there you go.
Yeah. Well, he's got good stuff, and he can throw strikes and see how he reacts if he's actually in real competition.
Yeah.
Which they knew what happened when I was in the rookie league, but when I came up in September, it was obvious that I had better stuff than most of our pitchers, but it was also obvious that I had those 500 innings or more of experience in the major leagues. So,
yeah.
I think they had nothing to lose by pitching me. The Colt 45s were so far out of the race, it didn't matter. But one thing that I know it did, and I think I heard something, it might have been St. Louis or Cincinnati, I can't remember. There were about four or five teams that year. The Phillies were the team that blew it in 64.
Yep.
When they kept pitching, bunting in short, and their arms wore out at the end of September.
Yep.
But there were four or five teams that could have won. And I pitched on my birthday, September 22nd. There was only about a week or 10 days left in the season. And so those teams that are in the race are looking at the box score, the wire tape up in the press box, and they're seeing that the Colt 45s are starting an 18-year-old kid against the Giants, which is one of the teams that was in contention. And they're probably thinking, well, that's where it goes against the unwritten rule that when you are a non-contender in September, that you do anything and everything you can do to put up stiff competition for the people that are in contention. And actually, since most of the teams I played on were in contention the last 2 weeks, for me it was sort of a badge of honor to knock somebody off that was in the race, because you knew they were trying with everything they had to beat you, because the postseason money was there, the thrill of winning a championship was there, and here the Colt 45s are sending some kid out to the mound.
Yeah, but the kid had a little something for him, didn't he?
Yeah, as it turned out.
Well, you know, people around here still talk about 64 and remember it because the Reds actually were in first place with about three games to go and lost two of the last three, including getting smoked 10-0 on the final day. And that's what got the Cardinals in there, because the Cardinals had already given up on their season. They'd fired Bing Devine and every other thing, brought Howsam in there, and he was going to rebuild the team, and all of a sudden they get a wild hair, and the Phillies collapse, and they go shooting right past everybody, including the Reds, and everybody turned around and said, well, what was that? So
did that last three losses cost somebody his job in Cincinnati?
I think that was the year that Fred Hutchinson started the year and then had to quit because the cancer had developed too far, and I think Dick Sisler took over. And I don't think Sisler got rehired after that. I might be wrong about that, but he didn't last long.
To begin with.
Yeah, he didn't last long, but he took over in like August. And you know, they finished reasonably decent, but they had hard times the last week of the season. They played a couple of 14, 16 inning games against non-contenders, and a lot of controversy about who they started in the final game. And, you know, Maloney was supposedly ready and they didn't use him, and they pitched John Sutouris instead and he got thumped. And they lost 10-0 in the last day when they still could have at least tied St. Louis. But the fact was that as of Thursday or Friday, they were the ones in first place and they could have won the whole thing. But it didn't happen. Bunting in short and hope for a whole lot of rain, I guess. But it didn't work.
Yes, we had that same situation in 1969 with the Astros. It was the first year that we had a contending team, and we were only a couple of games out midway through September. And then we had a tough extra inning loss in a game I pitched, and then after that we sort of collapsed. That was against the Braves. They were the eventual winner, but there were five teams in contention in the middle of September in the NL West. And I think we ended up fourth or something. But anyway, it's great for baseball when it comes down like that.
That's it for this episode of Durker and Hot on Baseball. Check us out on Facebook or at hotcorner.com.